Good evening, everyone. Good to be back here. If you have your Bibles, open them up to Hebrews chapter 12. Hebrews chapter 12, we want to look at Hebrews chapter 12 and 13, not tonight, but we're going to look at it as a unit, and I've entitled this section, Running the Christian Race. In fact, one person said this week, and I love the quote, there is only one race in the church, and it is the Christian race. Now, I know what it is to be in a race because in high school, my primary sport was football. But during the off season, I ran track. And you'll notice here, that's a picture of me in high school, and they entitled, All of Us Who Ran Track, Where's the Beef? Because it was me, and yeah, they called me No Neck Nimmer at that time. That was my nickname. And so the reason why they called it Where's the Beef is because it was me and several other guys. We ran the 220 relay. And I really enjoyed my time in track. So I understand the whole idea of running a race. Now, I didn't run cross country because I probably could not make it cross country during that time based on my weight. The Bible says all of us are in a Christian race. You entered the race when you got saved, and your race will be completed when you die. The length of your race is determined by God. Now, you're running the race in one of three ways. Every Christian is running it in one of three ways. Number one, you are running it full speed. Number two, you are coasting or you are loafing. And then number three, you have dropped out of the race. You are no longer running. The Bible makes it very clear in 1 Corinthians 9 that as Christians, we are to run with a maximum effort. We are not to loaf. We are not to coast. Obviously, we're not to stop running. Look what he says in 1 Corinthians 9, verse 24. Do you not know that in a race, all the runners run, but only one gets the prize? And notice what Paul says to the Corinthians, because they were familiar with the Isthmian Games. He says, run in such a way as to get the prize. In other words, run with a maximum effort. And there are a lot of Christians today that are not running with a maximum effort. They're coasting, they're loafing, or they've dropped out of the race and they've stopped running. And I think there are one of three reasons why many Christians are coasting or they're not running at all. Number one is because they are wounded. You know, as you run the Christian race, there are times you're going to get wounded in your Christian life. Other Christians are going to hurt you. And if you get wounded and you don't deal with that, you could end up coasting or you'll drop out of the race. For some Christians, they are weary. I think we've all been weary in the race. We've all been tired spiritually. And then finally, some Christians stop running because they are wayward. They end up getting sucked into the vortex of this world, and as a result of their waywardness, they no longer are running the race. Now remember, the writer of Hebrews is writing to a group of Jewish Christians, many of them supposedly had come to faith in Jesus Christ. A number of them, it was a genuine conversion. A number of them had come to the edge of Christianity. They made a profession of faith in Jesus Christ, but they weren't fully committing. And some of them were tempted to go back into Judaism. They were facing, according to chapter 10, persecution, the confiscation of their property. And as a result, some of them were tempted to defect back into Judaism. And as we've seen throughout our study of Hebrews, the writer tries to demonstrate that Jesus is superior to everything and everyone in the Old Testament, and he marshals those arguments through chapters 1 all the way to chapter 10. Now what he's going to do is challenge them not to go back into Judaism, but to run the race with endurance. Many of them were struggling, they were hurting, and as a result, they were tempted to not run the Christian race, just like you and I are. Again, you entered the race when you got saved, but the Christian race is a marathon. It is not a sprint. And a lot of Christians start off well in the Christian race, and what happens is they end up conking out. They either loaf and they become lukewarm Christians, which, by the way, is probably the main attitude in the American church today. There are a lot of people in the body of Christ that are just lukewarm. They identify with Christianity. Some of them are truly born again. They have enough fruit to show that they're saved, but they're not really running with a maximum effort. They're content where they're at. And then you got a number of Christians that have sort of stopped running because of weariness, woundedness, or waywardness. So how can you and I run the Christian race successfully? Well, what he's going to do is give us a number of principles in chapters 12 and 13 that will help us run the race successfully. Let me share with you some of them this evening. First of all, if you're going to run the race successfully, you must remember others who have run before you. You must remember others who have run before you. This serves as a motivation. Notice, if you will, chapter 12, verse 1. Therefore. What's the therefore, therefore? Well, on the basis of what he just said in chapter 11, mentioning all those people in the Hall of Fame of Faith, he says, therefore, since we have such a great cloud of witnesses surrounding us. Now, who are these cloud of witnesses? These cloud of witnesses are not people that are already in heaven right now, and they're sort of cheering us from heaven. There are some commentators that say that you have all these people up in heaven, Mount Zion, as he mentions in chapter 12, and they're up there sort of cheerleading along the way as you and I are running the race. Well, maybe that's true. I'm not there, so I don't know. But I don't think that's the intent of the author here. What he's talking about is the heroes of chapter 11. You'll see the next slide here. He gives the list. John went over all these people: Enoch, Noah, Moses, Rahab, on and on and on. They're the ones that ran the race before us. And guess what? They ran the race successfully. They had their struggles, they had their battles, they had their failures. But you know what they did? They ran the race and they completed it. And now they're in glory. And so what happens is when you and I run the Christian race, we get discouraged. And you know what motivates us to keep running? Is to remember saints in the past. Not only biblical saints, and that's why it's important that you study the lives of people in the Bible. Because you see what they did. You see how God worked in their life. And that serves as a motivation for you and I not to do the things that they did, and also to do some of the things that they did. And also to see that they ran the race and they finished and they have passed the baton to you and I. And therefore, we are now in this season of life and we are to take up the baton and run, because here's the deal. You're going to pass on that baton to the next generation. And it's not just biblical characters. I think people historically motivate us to keep running. One guy in particular that I love in church history is John Wesley. I've always had a fascination with John Wesley. I've read a number of his biographies. The man was an absolute workhorse. He got up at 5 in the morning and he went to bed at 10 o'clock every night. And he chided himself when he was 80-something years old because he slept in an hour later. That was the kind of guy. And notice what it says here about John Wesley. It says this: he averaged 15 sermons a week and preached more than 40,000 sermons in his career, and traveled 250,000 miles many times during an age when roads were often muddy ruts. See, he's a motivation for me. He ran the race well, and he motivates me to continue to run the race. Just recently, another gentleman that went to glory that all of us know about is Ravi Zacharias. Ravi Zacharias, as you know, was a global apologist. The man was highly intelligent, almost committed suicide, and he had a conversion experience. And as a result, God raised him up to go into a lot of universities and a lot of places to be able to preach to those who were agnostic or atheists. And he led a lot of people to Christ. His race is now finished. He just died several weeks ago. And here's what's interesting. If you'll notice the next picture up here, you will notice the guy standing next to him. His name is Nabil Qureshi. Nabil Qureshi was a committed Muslim, and he got saved, and he wrote a book called Seeking Allah, Finding Jesus. He was on the staff with Ravi Zacharias in Atlanta, RZIM Ministries. Well, Nabil would travel with Ravi Zacharias around the world. Well, about 4 years ago, Nabil Qureshi died of stomach cancer at 34 years old. He had one young daughter. Little did Ravi know that 4 years later, he would join Nabil in heaven. You see, all of those people have run their race. And listen, there's going to come a day when your race is done and my race is done. God determines the length of time. And so that's why we have to take it serious. And you know what motivates us to keep running the race is to remember that the saints in the past have passed the baton to you and I, and what are you going to do with it? I ran the 220 relay race, and I know when the baton was coming to me, what you have to do is you have to start, and as you are running, you grab the baton. You don't stay stationary and wait for the baton. You start running so that the baton can be passed off to you, and you run with the maximum effort. And so if you're discouraged to quit, remember the saints that have gone before you. You owe it to them. You owe it to the future generations to run the race with endurance. There's a second way that you and I can run the race successfully, and that is this. We must remove obstacles or hurdles in our life. We must remove obstacles or hurdles in our life. Notice verse 1. Therefore, since we have so great a cloud of witnesses surrounding us, that would be the people again that have gone before us in chapter 11, let us also, here it is, lay aside, and he mentions two things here. Every encumbrance. Encumbrance here in the Greek means dead weight. Lay aside every encumbrance, and here's the other thing. The sin which so easily entangles us. Now, whenever you and I run a race, we know in the Christian life, we're going to face obstacles. We're going to face hurdles. It's just part of the Christian life. In fact, some Christians will say, man, my life was a lot easier when I got saved. It seems like all kinds of problems began to happen in my life. And you know, you're going to face resistance in the Christian life. It's just part of it. And he mentions two potential obstacles that we all have to deal with. Number one would be encumbrances. An encumbrance is something that's not necessarily a sin. It's dead weight. It's something that slows us down in the Christian life. It's like running a race with combat boots on. Nothing wrong with running with combat boots, but here's the problem. It's going to slow you down. All of us know the times that we've been in traffic and we've been very irritated because traffic is very, very slow, and sometimes it comes to a standstill. Have you ever been there before? And as you're in traffic, you'll notice the picture up on the screen here. You will notice you're sitting there and you're thinking it's a major accident, but what does it end up being? Usually it's one car on the side of the road and you've driven by and you've said to yourself, are you kidding me? Traffic slowed up just for that one stinking car? Hopefully you didn't say other things in your mind. You see, that's an encumbrance. It's something that slows us down. It can be a person. It could be a place. It could be a thing. It could be a habit. Something that's not necessarily sinful, but it is slowing you down in the Christian race. For some of you, it could be the internet. It could be Facebook. Again, that's not necessarily wrong, but it's slowing you down. Then he mentions another thing, and this one's worse. He says the sin that so easily entangles us. Now, this is different because this actually trips us up. And in the Greek, it says literally this, the sin that entangles us. So it's a definite article in the Greek, which means it was something particular that was keeping the Hebrew Christians from running the race. Now, what is the sin? We don't know specifically, but it may have been the sin of unbelief because some of them were going to go back to Judaism. And so he says, deal with that sin. But we don't want to limit it just to the sin of unbelief. It could be any sin in your life. It could be a habit. It could be a relationship, and this is a big one that I've seen in a lot of Christians' lives. They start running the race well, and about 2 or 3 years into it, they meet somebody, they start dating them. That person's not a Christian, and I see them go by the wayside. I have seen that time and time again in my Christian experience. It could be alcohol. It could be drugs. It could be an addiction. It could be an affair. There's a multitude of things that can actually entangle us and trip us up. And what happens is we get into bondage and we stop running the race. I read years ago an article about a bear that actually got trapped in a car. You'll notice the picture here. This bear got into this car and could not get out. Evidently, it must have broke through the window. And so this cop had to open the door and actually let the bear out. Now imagine being that cop where you walk up and you have to open the door to try to get the bear out. You see, the bear got in, but the bear could not get out. Someone had to release him. And that's exactly what sin does. It entangles us, it traps us, it keeps us in bondage so that we don't run the Christian race. So let me ask you a question. You're in the race if you're a Christian by default. Every Christian is in the race. The issue is, how are you running? Is there an encumbrance in your life, or is there a sin that is habitual? Because we're all going to sin. We're all going to struggle. But is there some sin or some encumbrance that is keeping you from running the race? For some of you, it could be anger or bitterness. For some of you, you won't let go of the past. And as a result, you're not running the race like you should. You're angry at somebody. Or for some of you, it's materialism. That's your focus. That's the issue in the American church. So if you want to run the race, you got to deal with encumbrances and you got to deal with sin. And you know what I found in my life? It is never ending. As I'm running the Christian race, I'm always dealing with sin coming across my path. I have to deal with it on a regular basis in my mind and in my heart and my affections. Also, I have to be on guard against encumbrances. Is this something that's slowing me down in the Christian race? There's a third principle the writer of Hebrews tells us if you and I are going to run successfully, and that is this: we must persevere or we must not quit. We must persevere or don't quit. Look what he says in verse 1. Therefore, since we have so great a cloud of witnesses surrounding us, let us also lay aside every encumbrance and the sin which so easily entangles us. And he tells the Jewish Christians, let us run, here it is, with endurance, the race that is set before us. The word endurance means to bear up under difficult circumstances. You see, our Christian race is a marathon. It is not a sprint. We are going to face obstacles. We're going to face setbacks, which means this: we're going to experience resistance. We're going to experience discouragement. That's the whole idea behind the word endurance. You don't have to endure if it's not difficult. The Christian race is not always easy. I'm not saying it's always difficult, and I'm not saying there's no joy. Obviously, there is joy in the Christian life, but make no mistake about it, we wrestle not against flesh and blood. You and I, if we are running with a maximum effort, we are going to get resistance from the world, the flesh, and the devil. It is coming. If you are a spirit-filled, committed Christian, there is going to be resistance there, and you know what you have to do? You have to dig down deep by the power of the Holy Spirit and say, I am not going to quit. You may get knocked down. You may get discouraged. You may have seasons of depression. You may get derailed for a time, but you know what you do? You get back up and you keep running the race. We've all been distracted before. We've all been down for the count. But you know what you do? You get back up and you keep running. You are persistent and you don't quit. I was reading a historian this week who said the following about Christopher Columbus. If Columbus turned back, we would not have blamed him. But he goes on to say, but we never would have heard of him either. Harry Truman, as you know, was the 33rd president of the United States. This article that I read said that he opened a hat and a shirt shop at age 35. It went bankrupt after 2 years, and it took him 15 years to pay off the debt, but he was persistent. Or Dwight Eisenhower. He was the 34th president of the United States. This article said that he was rejected 3 times for a command position before being appointed Supreme Allied Commander in 1942, and he became the 34th President of the United States. You could go on and on with people historically who made an impact, who made a dent, and the reason why is because they did not quit. See, many of us don't bear the fruit that we want to bear is because we give up. We face minimal opposition or we face major opposition, and you know what we do? We throw in the towel and we say the Christian life isn't worth it. And you know what? There are times where you're going to be tempted to want to jump ship and say, I'm not doing this anymore. We all at times may reach a crisis of faith where we go, this isn't worth it. This is too hard. But we have to remember Galatians chapter 6. That we will reap a harvest if we do not give up. And so some of you tonight may be discouraged. Some of you may be in that mode where you're loafing. You've become spiritually lazy. I want to challenge you to get back in the race. I want to challenge you to start running the race with a maximum effort. And listen, if you're going to persevere in the race, you know what that means? It means you're in the Word. You're in prayer. You're seeking the Lord. It means you're involved in ministry. You don't come to church just to sit, soak, and sour. You want to get involved and you want to serve the Lord because you're motivated. There's another principle that the writer of Hebrews gives here, if you and I are going to run the race successfully, and that is this: we must focus on Jesus. We must focus on Jesus. Notice what he says in verses 2 through 4 of Hebrews 12, and I love this. He says, fixing our eyes on Jesus. Now, you and I know that whenever we run a race, there is a finish line. You and I began the race when the gun went off. That's when we got saved. And as we are running, like the Apostle Paul said in Philippians chapter 3, he says, we are focused on the finish line. We are focused on the upward call. And listen, Jesus is the one we are to focus on. He says, fixing our eyes on Jesus, the author and perfecter of our faith. The Greek word here literally means that Jesus is our trailblazer. Jesus is the originator of our faith. I think the better word here is the example. That's what he means here, the perfecter of our faith. Jesus is our consummate example. He is our trailblazer. Notice what it says about Jesus, who for the joy set before him. What was the joy set before him? Knowing that he was going to be back with the Father. John 17, he was going to be restored to the glory that he had before the foundation of the world. The joy set before him was the souls that he was going to purchase on the cross, who for the joy set before him endured the cross. You see their example there? He's telling these Jewish Christians, endure, and I want you to see Jesus as the example. He is the one who endured. He despised the shame. No one likes to be humiliated. He says, but now he is sitting at the right hand of the throne of God in a position of power and glory. And then he says this to the Jewish Christians and to you and I. For consider him. You see, there's the focus. Consider him who endured such hostility by sinners against himself. He says, I want you to think about what sinful Jewish people and the sinful Roman people did to our Lord. He says, so that you will not grow weary and lose heart. In other words, he's asking them to make a comparison. He says, I want you to compare your suffering. I want you to compare your race to the race that Jesus ran. I want you to compare your difficulties to the difficulties that Jesus went through so that you will not lose heart. And notice what he says, you have not yet resisted to the point of shedding blood in your striving against sin. He says, come on. I mean, look at Jesus. He sweat drops of blood in the garden, and then he shed his blood on the cross, which basically means he died a brutal death. He says, you haven't experienced what Jesus has experienced. Now listen, there are martyrs who have suffered greatly. There are martyrs who have been crucified. There are martyrs who have been tortured to death. There are Christians, and I've read articles about this, and I can't imagine it. It's like I put the book down or the article down because it makes me very uncomfortable. I've read stories where they have literally tortured the parent's child in front of them and say, if you don't deny Christ, I'm going to torture your child, and they do it. One guy passed out because they executed both of his daughters on the spot, and he passed out, and he saw a vision of his two daughters in glory. And he said he woke up and he said that emboldened him to stand against his persecutors. So yes, Christians have suffered immensely, but listen, no one ever suffered like Jesus. Why? He suffered physically, emotionally, mentally, and the worst suffering was he was separated from the Father. My God, why have you forsaken me? None of us will ever understand that in its fullness, but Jesus had only known intimacy with the Father throughout all eternity, and so for a brief period of time, there was a rupture in the fellowship with God. There was not a rupture in the Trinity, because God cannot be separated from God, but in Jesus' humanity, he was separated from the Father. And he says, look, I know it's tough, I know it's difficult, but you have to focus on Jesus. How many of you remember where you were when you saw the movie, The Passion of the Christ? Can you think about where you were, what theater you went to? By the way, Mel Gibson, I think next year or the year after that, is coming out with part 2 on the resurrection. And it's supposed to be better than the first one. And you know masses of people are going to go see it. But do you remember when you went to see for the first time The Passion of Christ? I was here in Columbia, South Carolina, and they gave a preview to all pastors before it actually hit the movie theaters. And I remember going, and everybody was in stunned silence. I saw it a second time, and do you remember when people walked out of the theater, there was just this quietness and there was this hush. I saw people crying because they realized the brutality. And by the way, you know why Mel Gibson really focused on the beating scene? And that was absolutely brutal, because I watch this every year around Easter. I have the DVD. And when I watch it, I cringe. You know why he did that? Because he has Catholic roots, and he wanted to focus in more on the sufferings of Christ, which typical Catholic theology does. But I think it gave us an understanding of the brutality. You see, we have to remember what Jesus went through. And you know what? Jesus is merciful and compassionate because he knows we're not like him. He knows. And he knows we cannot handle some of what happens to us in life. And so we have to focus on Jesus. And listen, the best way to do that is to get into the Word of God. And by the way, you know what motivated Jesus to suffer like that? To be back with the Father? But here was the issue, you and me. The souls that he was going to redeem, that was the joy set before him. That was the carrot stick. That was the motivation for Jesus to suffer. And you know what the motivation for you and I to endure as we focus on Jesus? We need to remember the carrot stick. What's the carrot stick? When we get to heaven, all our suffering is going to be gone. Listen, Ravi Zacharias right now, man, he doesn't have to deal with traveling the world. He doesn't have to deal with people mocking him anymore. He doesn't have to deal with all of his physical weaknesses that he had. Listen, he's in glory right now enjoying grape juice with Jesus. He's enjoying all of that. And the joy set before us. And you know what the other joy is? Knowing all the people that God's going to show that we impacted. I think one of the joys of heaven is to see the domino effect of our ministries. To see how when you touch this person's life, that person's life, touch that person's life, and on and on and on. We're going to see the joy of that. When I was growing up in Miami, Florida, I know it's kind of bad, but my dad took me to the dog races. Flagler Dog Track. Now, I was too young. I don't know if my dad betted on the races. I don't think he did. Dad, if you're listening, sorry I'm not exposing you. But we went to the dog races, and I don't remember much about it, but the only thing I remembered was in this picture, these greyhound dogs. You remember seeing those things? Very, very fast. And I remember the bell would sound, and those dogs would come out of the track. And you know what intrigued me about this? I'll never forget. If you look at the corner left of the screen, what do you see right there? What does that look like? Little rabbit. I'll never forget they had this electronic rabbit in front of those dogs, and the dogs just kept chasing it, going after it. That was their incentive as they ran around the track. You see, there's a rabbit out there. You know what the rabbit is? It's glory. It's all the people that we're going to impact. That's the joy set before us. That was the joy set before Jesus, and that's why Jesus endured. You say, well, Jesus had to endure because he's the Son of God. Absolutely. But that's the motivation for you and I. Well, there's a fifth principle as we wind down, and that is this. If you and I are going to run successfully, we must accept God's discipline in our life. We must accept God's discipline in our life. Notice what he says in verses 5 through 11. This is a pretty lengthy section. He says to these Jewish Christians, and have you forgotten, which we often do, we have to be reminded, haven't you forgotten the exhortation which is addressed to you as sons? And what he's going to do here is quote Proverbs chapter 3 in the Old Testament. My son or daughter, do not regard lightly the discipline of the Lord, nor faint when you are reproved by him. So whatever these Jewish Christians were going through, he says, listen, don't faint because God is disciplining you, and I'll get into what that means. For those whom the Lord loves, verse 6, he disciplines and he scourges every son that he receives. He says it is for discipline, verse 7, that you endure. God deals with you as with sons. For what son is there whom his father does not discipline? Now, if you come from a good home, obviously your parents are going to discipline you. He's not saying that there aren't exceptions to this. In fact, in our day and time, we're seeing less and less discipline take place, and that's why we're seeing America go to hell in a handbasket. It's because of the breakup of the home. He says, but if you are without discipline, of which all of us have become partakers, then you are illegitimate children and not sons. In other words, if you're not disciplined, you obviously don't belong to a family or they don't care. And he could be saying here that if you are never disciplined as God's child, you are not a legitimate child of God. Furthermore, verse 9, we all had earthly fathers to discipline us and we respected them. Now at the time we didn't respect them, we got mad at them. He says, shall we not much rather be subject to the Father of spirits and live? In other words, submit to God's discipline. Don't argue with God. For they disciplined us, verse 10, for a short time as seemed best to them, but he disciplines us for our good so that we may share in his holiness. That's the purpose of God's discipline. All discipline for the moment seems not to be joyful but sorrowful. Yet those who have been trained, interesting word in the Greek there, we get the word gymnasium. God puts you in the gymnasium of discipline. That's how God trains you. That's how he builds your spiritual muscles. But notice what happens. Afterwards, it yields the peaceful fruit of righteousness. Now, here's his point. These Jewish Christians were going through difficulty and struggle. And he says, here's the perspective that I want you to have. I want you to see the trial that you're going through as God's loving discipline. He compares God to a good parent. And he says, God is our heavenly Father. And listen, just as an earthly father who loved his children disciplines them, he says, God disciplines you. And so all suffering in our life is a form of God's discipline. Now, you have to understand, in that day, discipline wasn't just for wrongdoing. We often think that discipline means that we have done something wrong. I know for me in my life growing up, most of my discipline was for wrongdoing. I got in trouble all the time. In fact, my mom was old school. My mother's Middle Eastern. And my mom was a stay-home mom. Remember back in the 70s when a lot of moms would stay home? And my mom told me, I had a younger brother, older sister. They were good. I was the middle child. My mom will tell you, if she was up here, she said, I wore a belt around my neck for Michael. That's what she said. My mom had to discipline me all the time. One of the things that I did all the time was I would break windows. I would bust out car windows. I would bust out house windows. And I've mentioned to you this before, but you probably forgot. I was with another guy one time, and we walked by a parked car in my neighborhood in Miami, and the window was down. And I had a book of matches, and I said, this would be interesting. So I flicked the match in the car. And I took off. I was at home and I'm hearing fire engine trucks. And I'm in the backyard and I'm watching this huge billow of smoke go up in the air. And I am panicking. I was about 6 years old. And my mom comes home and she comes to the backyard and she says, Michael, she said, did you see that car on fire over there? And I looked at her, and she looked at me, and she goes, did you do that? And I cowered in fear. And my mom had keys with leather strips on them. And I remember she tore me up. My mom wasn't abusive, but listen, when you come from a Middle Eastern home, you know, plates work just as well as anything else. And so my mom tore me up. I can give you incident after incident. My mom had to discipline me. My dad did, but my mom took care of most of it on Mother's Day. I like to climb. In fact, when I was 2 years old, my mom let me play in the backyard. I think it was two or three. And I like to climb. So there was a chain link fence we had. I climbed over the chain link fence and I got out of the house and I wandered the neighborhood. My mom was pregnant with my brother. And when she went out in the backyard to check on me, she said I was nowhere to be found. I was getting ready to cross a major thoroughfare. I could still see it in my mind's eye. My mom turned the corner at mock speed with her 9-month pregnant brother. And she ran towards me. And I remember she picked me up and held me real close and was kissing me. And then she was like, I'm going to kill you when we get home. Mother's Day, because I like to climb. I went up into the medicine cabinet and I grabbed baby aspirin, the kind that had the flavor, the orange flavor, and I ate it. And then when she came to my room, she said, Michael, where'd you get this bottle? I said, candy. The next thing I knew, I had tubes down my stomach, pumping my stomach. I was crying. My mom disciplined me. And you know what? She is responsible for where I am today. Because my mom was firm. I was out to lunch. She curbed my nature. And that's what God does. He disciplines us for our good. But listen, it's not just trials in our life. God, we did something wrong and God's hitting us over the head. Discipline in the Bible is also training. We know this when we tell our children, clean up your room. I remember telling our daughter one time, clean up the room. She said, I don't want to clean it up. I said, you're not leaving the room until you pick up all your toys and put them there. And she started to scream and cry, and she did it. And you know what I noticed? As I told her, the next time it got easier. Brush your teeth. I don't want to brush my teeth. You're going to brush your teeth. What are you doing? You're training. So training is positive reinforcement to develop habits, but it's also to discipline when there's wrongdoing. God does both. God shapes our character, He shapes our nature, and God makes us more holy. That's the purpose of discipline. So He's saying, look, make sure you have the perspective that God is treating you as His child. If He doesn't discipline you, you're not His child. And so, if you're going through a difficulty, I know it's hard. You got to see it as God's training in your life to make you more holy, to mature you. You say, it's not fair, Mike. Why is it that I suffer a lot more than other Christians and I do the right thing? I don't know. Let me say this. God doesn't necessarily send every discipline in your life. God doesn't sit up in heaven and go, I'm going to discipline you and discipline you like God is some cosmic killjoy. Life happens. God is sovereign over the circumstances of life. And life happens, but He uses it to train us. Well, there's one more principle here as we close, and then we're going to have our time of prayer. And that is this. We must consider our impact on other people. As we run the Christian race, we must consider our impact on other people. Do you realize that when you don't run the Christian race or you drop out of the race, you have a negative impact on other people? Notice what He says to these Jewish Christians beginning in verse 12. He says, therefore, strengthen the hands that are weak. Again, He's back to the running metaphor here. And He says, strengthen the hands that are weak. The Greek literally means hands that are drooping, can't hold them up. Now, if you've seen anybody run in a marathon, we're not going to show the video right now. I'm going to show it to you in about 2 minutes. And you're going to see this runner, as she's getting ready to cross the finish line, her hands begin to droop. When you get extremely tired, your hands begin to droop. You know what He's saying? Get back into the race, He's saying. And He's saying, strengthen your hands that are weak. And then He says, and the knees that are feeble. The Greek word literally means wobbly, weak. See, what happens in a race when you're fatigued, your hands begin to droop and your legs become wobbly, as we're going to see in the video in a minute. He's saying, I want you to get back in the race. I want you to strengthen your hands that are weak. In other words, pull them up, because you and I know, I ran track. When you run, you got to keep your arms up like this if you're going to get the maximum speed. I ran the 40-yard dash. And so it was imperative that your arms were involved in the process like this. He's saying, I want you to pick your hands up. I want you to deal with your knees that are wobbly. And He says, make straight paths for your feet. You know what the Greek word means? Stay in your lane. Stay in your lane. Because what happens is, when your hands droop and you become wobbly, you get out of your lane and you affect other people. You ever watch a NASCAR race? What happens? When one car gets out of its lane, it hits the other car and then a domino effect happens. See, He's saying, I want you Jewish Christians to straighten up, get back into the race, deal with your limping hands, deal with your wobbly knees. Why? Make straight paths for your feet. Here it is. So that the limb, which is lame, may not be put out of joint, but rather healed. This is a medical term right here. The limb which is lame will not be put out of joint. Here's what He's saying. When you and I stop running the race, or we loaf, we are going to cause other Christians to become spiritually disjointed. That's the Greek word here. You're going to cause other Christians to be put out of joint. Rather, you should run the race so that they will be healed. And so he's saying here, look, there are some Jewish Christians that are close to coming to Jesus. And if you Christians who have made a profession of faith, if you go back to Judaism, you know what you're going to do to those people that are on the edge, that are watching you? You may influence them to go back to Judaism. Don't do that. Some of you, by going back to your old life, you know what you're doing? You're setting a bad example for your children. You're setting a bad example for other people, your friends that know you, people in the church. See, we have to realize that we don't sin in a vacuum. Our lives impact other people, and we have to remember that. And so we got to run with endurance. Now, as we close, watch this video, and you're going to see this whole idea of the hands drooping and the knees wobbling. When I come back up, I'll stay up here. I'll tell you when to cut it. Watch this video. Pretty interesting. Volume.
Comes within feet of the finish line, but she just can't make it.
This is our winner, ladies and gentlemen. This is not normally what you expect to see at the finish of a marathon.
Chandler Self was leading the Dallas Marathon, but was running on empty.
When I watched that video, I think I cringed just like everyone else. I've had friends and family text me and say, you know, I was really, really worried about you.
Chandler could see the finish line when she collapsed for the first time. That's when a complete stranger came to help her up. All Chandler could think about was getting disqualified by the gesture of humanity.
Ariana, the 17-year-old high school student, was really trying to help me out, and I even tried to push her away, but her heart was just overcome with kindness and compassion for me that I think she just was like, I gotta help her.
Then it happened again and again before finally crossing the finish line after 26.2 miles.
When you can't run,
you, all right, you can cut it.
Can't walk, you crawl, and no matter.
You see how her knees and hands begin to wobble? And you know what? She needed someone to help her, and you know we do too. Because we get discouraged, we need people in our life that are going to pick us up and lift us up. So what are the principles that we've learned tonight? Let's review them, and then we're going to have our time of prayer. First of all, if you're going to run the race, remember others who have run before you. That's critical. Number two, remove obstacles or hurdles, encumbrances or sin. Number three, persevere or don't quit. Number four, focus on Jesus. Number five, accept God's discipline in your life. God is training you. He's making you more holy. Number six, consider your impact on other people.